Hello, this is the Fiction Nonfiction Podcast from Literary Hub, where we believe that every issue in your Twitter feed or on the evening news has already been tackled somewhere in literature. I'm Whitney Terrell, the author of the novel The Good Lieutenant.
And I'm Vivi Ganeshanathan, also known as Sugi, author of the novel Love Marriage.
So, the National Decision Day for graduate students was Thursday, April 15th. We're recording on Sunday, April 18th, so this is all fresh. At least in my mind, how are things at the University of Minnesota MFA program?
We're excited to have great students coming to join us next fall. I don't know how much is fresh in my mind at the moment. I'm 24 hours post my second vaccine dose, but here we are.
Oh, that's nice.
How did things go at UMKC?
It was great. I'm excited about our class. It's going to be kind of big, which is good. I've got no complaints. This is my first year directing the program. So there's me on the phone with a lot of students, you know, talking to them, cajoling them, helping them, apologizing if we don't have enough money, which, you know, we don't ever have enough money. So, but in the end, you know, getting a bunch of new students is very promising. They're optimistic. They're enthusiastic. They want to study writing. I like that part of the process.
It is actually really heartening, admissions. It's kind of a helpful reminder of why we do what we do, seeing all those new students on their way into a program, which is why we decided to devote this new episode to a discussion of what all these incoming MFA students are likely to find or not find in the creative writing programs they're entering.
In particular, we want to talk about the ways that craft discussions and traditional workshop teachings are grounded in longstanding cultural assumptions about race, class, gender, nationality, and sexual orientation.
And how being aware of that grounding, rather than defensive about it, can help to create a better workshop environment for incoming students.
Today, we're going to talk to Matthew Salesis. Matt is the author of the best-selling The 100-Year Flood, an Adoptive Family's Best Book of 2015, and a Best Book of the Season at BuzzFeed, Refinery29, and Gawker, as well as the books I'm Not Saying, I'm Just Saying, Different Racisms on Stereotypes, the Individual, and Asian American Masculinity, and The Last Repatriate. His essays can be found in Best American Essays 2020, NPR, Code Switch, The New York Times Motherlode, The Guardian, and other venues. Today he's here to discuss Craft in the Real World, an Esquire Best Book of 2021, which explores alternative models of craft and the writing workshop, especially for marginalized writers, and his latest novel, the Penn Faulkner finalist, Disappear, Doppelganger, Disappear, a Thrillist.com Best Book of 2020. Welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me. Sorry if my kids interrupt. I just heard them come in downstairs.
My kid's playing Rocket League in the next room, but he's told to be very quiet and not celebrate. Okay, so one of the very first phrases in your book that made me smile was this one. The mystical writer uses the myth of his genius to gain power. He benefits from keeping up the illusions that he has a natural talent and that writing cannot be taught. I feel like I met some of these people when I was going to school.
Yeah, me too.
The mystical writer con is the very first thing that I would teach any incoming MFA student to be wary of, not to do. Why do you think it's so prevalent in the writing world?
I think it's, you know, it's easiest and best for the mystical writer to feed the myth. Sometimes I read these interviews and I'm like, I don't know if this is made up or not, but it seems like it's just like building the myth up so that, you know, you continue getting these gigs where you can speak about craft without actually speaking about craft and make yourself look like a genius. I mean, you know, that's a kind of cynical way of looking at things, but I'm usually a pretty cynical person.
I think it's true. I also think there's a weird thing way in which the industry is complicit in that, like biographies, you know, or mythologizing instruments, even sometimes interviews, you know. Like, I feel like I'm a particular critic of the interview, which is that it always has to be about the person's background and encourages self-mythologizing rather than talking about the artificiality of the text. I think like those are all things that contribute as well.
I am thinking, as we're having this conversation, about many years ago, I was at a reading where, I heard about a reading from a friend where a writer came in and basically like sort of put on a really extravagant performance. And then that writer came to the school where I was teaching, and I was sitting next to a colleague in the back row, and I said, God, I wish I had a persona. He was like, Sugi, you're hired to do work that like maybe you wouldn't be hired for if you had this person's persona. And I was like, okay, a really good point. There is this kind of, it's fun to like look at magic, but then there are like writing is teachable. And your book gets at this in really wonderful ways. There are a lot of craft ideas in workshop that are generally thought of as objectively true, like the difference between round and flat characters, or the validity of Freytag's pyramid of rising action, climax, falling action, denouement. But you have a really interesting thought experiment early in the book that suggests how even these truths are culturally determined. I should say, my fiance writes about Korean cinema and literature. And so like, I found all of your examples like super useful. could you take our listeners through your query culture versus ask culture example?
Yeah, sure. So the example is just kind of looking at a simple craft rule that I also teach, and that, I think it's a pretty good thing to teach students, if they're kind of writing within our culture, to readers within our culture, which is that using the words say and ask, the dialogue tag say and ask instead of other dialogue tags, is a way to kind of shift the focus from how somebody's saying something to just who's saying it, right? And because we read a lot of the words say and ask, they become sort of invisible words, or we read over them without really registering them that much. Whereas like if you wanted something else to happen where the emphasis would be on how it's being said, like whispered or something, then you would use that dialogue tag. But, you know, kind of standard case is say and ask for those reasons. It's an experiment to think about, like, if we just use the words query and comment more often, or stated and questioned or whatever, then those would be the invisible words, of course. And those words would be the most easy words to put in there so that people kind of don't register, or less register, how something's being said, and just kind of more register who's saying it. In the workshop, when we're thinking about like how the reader reacts to different things, we're thinking about a reader who reads a lot of fiction and so understands certain things about fiction without being told them. But of course, that's within like a specific literary tradition. And so if you kind of take somebody who's used to a different literary tradition in which they used comment and queried, then and we ask them to use say and ask because it's, you know, rules that make sense in our literary tradition, then they would either bring those rules back to their audience and people would be like, why is this person using, you know, say and ask all the time? Like, it's really standing out and annoying me. Or they would have to kind of fight the workshop and, you know, make a case for doing something else. And the workshop would probably focus, as workshops often do, on the things, you know, on bringing these issues to the foreground when really like other things could be used to talk about that would be more helpful to the author.
Now, Matthew, I want to make clear about one thing. You are not advocating that we get rid of attribution, because I am having a devil of a time teaching my students how to just use it at all.
Is it like a screenplay thing? I sometimes think like some of the things, you know, that I see, especially like my undergrads coming in with, are like things that they're getting from like watching a lot of TV and movies.
I do find that undergraduates, they're like, I'm like, look, you have to, this is how you have to have, you know, he said or she said this thing, and there's a comma, and then, you know, and they're like, no one's ever taught us that. I'm like, why is this not happening? This is totally off subject. I apologize. It's just a thing for me. But when I was reading about your attribution thing, I was like, yes, I agree, but can we also please just teach attribution period at all? In any way.
I mean, it's a choice, right? It's like any other choice. You're choosing whether or not you actually, you know, whether you want emphasis to be put on people being able to clearly understand who's speaking in which case, or whether you're, you know, feeding into, I don't know, whatever you want to do where you don't attribute things. Maybe you kind of want the confusion of a messy conversation between multiple people. Maybe, you know, whatever. The idea you're speaking to is people are just not doing anything consciously. And so like to make the choice, we want to make the choice for reasons that we have.
Yeah, I totally agree. And, you know, you make a choice to use that query culture versus ask culture example to sort of cool down the discussion and take out contemporary issues like race, class, gender, sexual orientation. But of course, the way a white majority workshop, which describes most workshops in America, approaches, say, a writer of color is very relevant to the discussion here. You were born in South Korea and adopted by American parents, so you're writing from a position of experience with this. I wonder if you could read to us a little bit about that dynamic.
Yeah, sure. So I'll just read a little bit from around page 10, which is in the Pure Craft is a Lie chapter.
Hey, it's Kaylee Cuoco for Priceline. Ready to go to your happy place for a happy price? Well, why didn't you say so? Just download the Priceline app right now and save up to 60% on hotels. So whether it's Cousin Kevin's Kazoo Concert in Kansas City, go Kevin! Or Becky's Bachelorette Bash in Bermuda, you never have to miss a trip ever again. So download the Priceline app today. Your savings are waiting.
Go to your happy place for a happy price. Go to your happy price, Priceline.
Writers of color in a workshop where the craft values are implicitly white, or LGBT writers in a workshop where the craft values are straight and cis, or women writers in a workshop where the craft values are patriarchal, and so on, are regularly told to know the rules before they can break them. They are rarely told that these rules are more than just craft or pure craft, that rules are always cultural. The spread of craft starts to feel and work like colonization. Let us take a look at one final example focusing on the use of sensory details. Fiction writers are often taught the three following strategies for using sensory details in their stories. 1. Choose striking or lasting or unusual or so forth details. 2. Leave out unnecessary or common details. And 3. Defamiliarize the familiar. Imagine that one of the three writers of color in the workshop submits a story about characters of color. For the purpose of the example, we will imagine that the workshop is taught the three strategies above and is supposed to address them in the manuscript. Let's go over some typical comments. Since these are comments I have heard and or experienced firsthand, let's pretend the story is about Korean Americans in Korea. We'll explore two separate possibilities, one in which the writer takes the advice of cultural craft, and one in which the writer resists that craft. For convenience, let's start with the first two strategies and come back to the third later. So, say the writer has taken the first two pieces of advice, choose striking details and leave out common details. He's included what he thinks are striking details, the fish a man is taking home on the subway, the man's incorrectly buttoned coat, the smell of unwashed bodies, the slickness of the bodies pressed close, all details which will be important to some kind of plot concerning the man with the fish. And he has left out other details that are unnecessary to the story. In this scenario, it would not be surprising to hear the workshop say that the writer has not done the things that he in fact did, i.e., including unusual details and leaving out unnecessary details. The other writers might suggest he include details like, an extreme example, passengers eating kimchi in their box lunches. This seems like a reasonable suggestion to them because the strategies for using sensory details assume a white audience and white cultural norms. In other words, the writer should be addressing white Americans who may have experienced the smell of unwashed bodies, but would be struck by the vivid details of the smell of kimchi or so forth. There might even be a white American in the workshop who speaks up to say he's been to Korea and goes on to give some examples of what he found unusual. As an opposite scenario, say the writer resists the craft lessons and, following other writers of color he has read, and writing against stories in which white expats in Asia eat exotified food on the Lunar New Year, etc., tries to include details that would be common and recognizable to a Korean American audience. Details, for instance, like how the man with the fish can tell by the protagonist's clothes that he's a gyopo. Maybe the writer includes these recognizable details because he knows how little fiction there is about people like him, and he believes that representation is important. In this workshop, the other writers might ask him to define gyopo if it is supposed to be a striking detail. They might complain that if it is not a striking detail, the writer should cut it. They might complain that the word is not clear to them, or that if it is supposed to be a common word, the writer should cut it. They might say that the spell of the story was broken for them when they encountered a word they didn't know and couldn't figure out from context clues. Again, these would be appropriate responses if the point of craft is to meet the expectations of an audience who is not like the writer.
Thank you so much. There's so much in your book that is so helpful. I found that the way that it addresses the questions of who the audience is really explicitly to be tremendously helpful. And I kind of was like, can I rewind, 15 years and go to my MFA classroom where I was asked certain questions and, let myself know that this book is coming out. anyway, we had...
It's so helpful to have those specific examples. You know, I think that really makes a big difference.
And some of the other examples in the book, we had Gish Jen and Peter Ho Davies on our last episode talking about anti-Asian violence in the wake of the shootings in Atlanta. And I noticed that you quote Gish several times in the book as an example of a writer who combines Eastern and Western craft. And I think our listeners would be really interested to hear the specific examples you cite about the differences between these two traditions. Could you talk a little bit about that?
Yeah, so I'm kind of quoting from or summarizing from Tiger Writing. She talks about kind of Western and Eastern storytelling practices, and she uses her own dad's memoir as an example, which is, it's utterly fascinating to me. He spends like two-thirds of the book, the first two-thirds, talking about like his house, the house that they grew up at, you know, like where he grew up in, and like the family tree and all of these other things that aren't like specifically including him, and then kind of gets around to his life at the end. And this seems like an appropriate way to tell a story of who he is because of the way that he's thinking of himself in context, right, in this larger context of his family, versus the way, like, you know, I think it'd be pretty rare to find like a white American's memoir doing that kind of work for most of the book, just because, you know, we typically assume that a memoir will kind of start in some point in the narrator's, author's life, specific, you know, to them, their life. And then she also, there's also something that I found really interesting. She talks about how there's a study where white readers and Asian readers read a passage in which a character does a bunch of things and count how many actions happen. And white readers count every single thing that happens as one act, as each thing as an action. And Asian readers tend to count a few things that seem to happen together as an action. She calls it episodic specificity. And so that there's a different sense of like what constitutes an episode or not. And she writes about how as a kid or, you know, earlier in her life, she really, you know, like the kind of Western agency individual character who kind of conquers all the odds or whatever through his own will was very appealing to her, and still seems to me too like a pretty appealing story. And she talks about how she had to kind of counter her own tendencies, cultural tendencies of, you know, the way that her dad was talking about who a person is as like not so much a matter of individual will, but a sort of understanding of historical and familial and cultural context. I was trying to think about like what happens if you don't kind of want to accommodate the more kind of Western storytelling structures into the way that you're writing. You know, what happens if you kind of leaned into the more Eastern ways of counting out episodes and the ways of thinking about who a person is, and wrote more for an audience who would naturally maybe count three actions as one action versus each thing as an individual step.
The middle of the book is devoted to redefining or at least rediscussing certain basic creative writing craft topics like conflict, character arc, setting, and pacing. And I can verify that these are actual topics because we do routinely teach them. We are not going to be able to go over all these here, although I would encourage listeners to check it out. But I wondered if you could redefine one craft topic that is near and dear to my heart, only because I really suck at it, and that is plot.
So the idea of plot that I am kind of trying to put forward or define and redefine in the book is one that focuses more on like what we do about consequences. I think it's, I say acceptance or rejectance, or rejection of consequences. And for me, there's a kind of battle raging in my imagined, idea of history in America between the sort of like individual agency on the one hand, free will, and the kind of much more fate-oriented idea of things that happen to us, circumstances kind of dictating much more of our lives. Like Jen, I kind of grew up with these stories, you know, both in books and in life, and, you know, my parents and my family and my friends, where I was supposed to be able to kind of conquer all problems through my own decision-making power. And I found it pretty difficult to do this, you know, because no matter how much I thought that I was white, which was kind of a real and lived thing for me as a kid, you know, it didn't really translate to how other people saw me and how I was treated. And much of my life seemed kind of to have been taken from one track and put on another track completely, which was, you know, obviously not a matter of free will. And so my kind of experience of being in the world is much, seems much more about circumstances, much more about kind of power and context and history and war and, you know, violence and racism and all kinds of things. Those things seem to have much more kind of effect on the consequences that I either have to accept or reject. And I think if we're, I was trying to kind of create definitions that could hold these various ways of thinking about plot. And so I was trying to kind of find out, like, what was the operative thing that was happening here? And it seems to me, one of the things we talk about, I talk about a lot with my classes is consequences. And it seemed like a way that a definition could kind of accommodate these different different plot theories or whatever was through thinking about what happens, what do people do with the consequences? Like, how much do we resist those consequences? How much do we kind of like just accept that they're a part of our lives? You know, like, how much do they affect the next thing that we do or think or feel?
That's great. As you're talking both about the individual and collective and the way that we understand action and the way that we think about like agency, I think that this also, of course, and the book gets at this in different ways, like to think about psychological realism and interiority and the kind of terrain that that takes up. And, you know, the examples that I'm thinking of here where there are books that fall outside this, like The Handmaid's Tale, right? Where there's this character that so many people have latched onto with such great attachment who has a very limited set of choices. Or I remember many years ago, and I haven't freshly watched this, so I hope my reference is right, but I remember watching the movie Drumline and having a real expectation of, I know it's like an example out of left field, but like having this expectation that the hero of the movie was going to like, in a really individual way, kind of like quote unquote win at the end of the movie. I must have been a teenager and I was sitting there at the end, but like a drumline does not work individually.
Right.
And so I was like sitting there like, this is very interesting. It's like a narrative conclusion.
What happens at the end? I don't know that movie. I haven't seen it.
Like there's a collective performance. Right. And it doesn't like, even the camera work, like doesn't highlight an individual in the way that I had been taught to expect. And it was like a Hollywood movie. And so I remember just being like a little boggled. Or another example, I often teach A Fine Balance, which in its way is like a really old fashioned novel, but it doesn't, like so much happens to the characters. And I taught it like in a political literature class, and people love this novel. Like, why do they love, they are able to love it, although it doesn't follow the conventions that they expect, given that they're coming from this Western majority audience set of expectations. And so I think like one of the things I hope for is like people learning to read better, but even that is not an expectation that most people bring to their own reading. They don't start reading hoping at the end of this, I'm a better reader. And I think both of your books made me a better reader, which I so appreciated.
Thank you.
Well, that, you know, that debate between, is it the system that you need to be writing about, or is it the individual's triumph over or against the system? I mean, that you can see that Jim McPherson, who was our professor that we talk about quite a bit on the show, he used to always talk about that Richard Wright and Ralph Ellison had a sort of differing opinion on this, right? That Native Son is a book that's about, well, the system will triumph and must triumph and is ineluctably going to triumph, and that Invisible Man is a book where Ellison posits a possible, you know, way of transcending the systemic racism that the character is experiencing. And that debate's happening. I mean, I'm not going to answer which one is right, but it's interesting that debate is there.
So your book also has this really marvelous section critiquing the decentering of the author in the workshop, which I think is one of the hottest topics about the workshop at present. And I wonder if you could talk a little bit about what that means and how that connects to this discussion of race and privilege within the workshop.
Yeah, sure. So, you know, the typical workshop just kind of by nature decenters the author.
I don't think the mystical writers are going to appreciate being decentered.
Well, you know, the mystical writers probably don't do a lot of workshopping. They kind of probably believe in their own genius, right? The workshop, you know, could be a thing where you, like, the author doesn't even really need to be there. You know, a colleague was saying to me the other day, like, maybe they could just tape the workshop and then play it for the writer later. Because they're so not a part of the workshop at all when you're just kind of being silent and sitting there while other people are talking about the work, as if you aren't the writer of the work and have nothing to say about it. And the basic idea is trying to just get the author back at the center of the workshop and invest the power of, like, feedback and criticism and you know, process back into the author themselves. I mean, who's writing the story is really the question at hand. I think it's a pretty simple thing to consider.
I mean, that's led, you know, I've been thinking about this a lot in recent years. Beth Wynn, who's a friend of ours who has been on the show, has written about it a fair amount on social media, and I started to read books about it, and it's changed the way that I do the workshop, and it seems easy, you know? The other thing is, like, to resist that idea that you should stop decentering the author, you know, you have a line here, for more privileged writers, their decentering in the workshop is countered by their centering in the rest of the culture. So it's easier if you're the majority to sort of be quiet and stay out of the way. But if you're a minority student and suddenly you're having a group from the majority discuss your work and perhaps not in the most intelligent way ever, that is a more difficult project, it seems like to me.
I have a few pet theories on this topic.
That's what you're here for.
One is that, like, it makes a sort of sense for the workshop to be silent and for somebody to kind of listen to their peers talk about the work if, like, everybody's basically got this a very similar cultural background, you know, and especially if people are kind of used to being heard, you know, a lot, right? Like, you know, a kind of straight white male upper middle class Protestant person, right, is probably the prototype of the writer's workshop, and in that context it might be useful for somebody to say, you know, shut up and listen to 11 other people very much like them who are their ideal audience tell them what they see in the work.
So maybe the mystical writer would be okay with the decentering. I was wrong at the beginning.
Well, I don't know if the mystical writer would be aware that their race was even a part of the work. You know what I mean?
Oh, that's for sure.
The workshop as it is now, right, of course, is not so homogenous, hopefully. And people who come to writing, here's the other pet theory, a lot of them, I think, are looking in to get out of writing the kind of agency that they don't get in life, right? That on the page, you make decisions, right? You have the power to make every single decision that happens on the page. And for me, the process of revision is a process of, like, making more and more conscious and conscientious decisions so that, like, even if you start with a kind of mess of your unconscious, and this is, I think, why people say it's similar to therapy, you work through various drafts until you have something that kind of stands much closer to your intentions, whatever they are at that point in time. I think for me, they change a lot. And for some people, they kind of are more similar to where they start from. But when you take that and you get into workshop, you know, and you're a marginalized person in life and you're constantly kind of that agency and that storytelling power is taken from you all the time, and you've gone to the page to find it, and then you get in the workshop and the place where, like, you've kind of put your hard work and personal investment on the page and given it to all these other people who are also, like, very invested in it, ideally, and who've read it really carefully, and yet kind of try to, you know, whether intentionally or not, take that from you and make it theirs, is a pretty hard place to sit in, and not necessarily very good for your writing. I would kind of argue it's pretty bad for your writing. And then the kind of back end of it, right, where you know, a very privileged writer can step out, as you were saying, Gwit, like into the real world and have their privilege reaffirmed, have their kind of storytelling and their voice reaffirmed. That doesn't happen for somebody who then steps back into a world where, like, you know, six people who like vaguely look like them have been shot in Atlanta or something. You know, like, you know what I mean? You don't get to get, the world isn't going to re-empower you.
So this conversation is deeply compelling for me. I'm interested in your thoughts on how this matters to someone who's a reader, not a writer, who's interested in politics and literature, who is on board with everything that you're saying, would be happy to call it quits with creative writing workshops entirely, and who comes here for us to talk about politics and the news and literature and how those things are knit together and not the process of writing, and is so incredibly bummed to hear us talking about workshop yet again. How do you think that someone who identifies primarily as a reader thinks about the concepts you're offering up in your book?
I mean, you brought up something earlier about, like, why don't we go into a book thinking, like, this can help us become better readers. And I think, actually, like, people do go into books, some people do go into certain books, at least, thinking, like, this will help me to become a better reader. And that people go into books thinking, like, this will help me to become a better person. And I don't think those things are that disconnected. I actually think they, you know, like, if we have a lot of faith in books, we probably think they're fairly connected indeed. And probably, like, the, you know, demographic information about, like, who reads a lot of books and what kind of politics they generally have, or et cetera, probably bear that out, I would think. And I think, you know, as we become better readers, we become better people. As we become better writers, we become better people. And we're kind of opening our minds to, like, different ways of telling a story and different ways of being in the world. And that's always going to be, hopefully, a helpful thing for us as we live our own kind of one life that's, you know, connected to all these other lives.
I would say to somebody who doesn't care about workshops, I would say, well, if you don't understand the politics that go into how writing is made, then you're misunderstanding writing. You're not seeing everything that's there. And it's much easier for you to make mistakes, you know, create a mythical figure out of a writer who doesn't deserve to be a mythical figure. If you don't understand the politics that go into the making of the art, I think you're misunderstanding the art, you know. And art, as you said, writing is power, and art is a kind of power. And so even if you're not a writer, you need to understand the power dynamics that go into the creation of art and the selling of art in order to consume art properly, I think.
I mean, I'm kind of all for the mystery on some level. You know, I don't know how much I would understand exactly, especially like books that aren't written toward me, which are most books, some of those questions. But I do think, like, people are constantly asking, you know, like, how can I kind of read more diversely, or like get into these other literary traditions? And I think part of what stops us is when we start reading something we're unfamiliar with, we kind of can sometimes come up against that unfamiliarity as a kind of challenge to our aesthetic sensibility. And the book hopefully can help people, and I've sort of seen this, you know, just on Twitter and stuff, help people to see, like, that there are different ways in which a book can be good, and maybe, like, the ways that we've expect a book to be powerful and impactful might not apply to a book that we're trying to read from a different literary tradition, for example. And if we're trying to really get into that tradition, like, we may need to kind of give this book more of a chance, and maybe also kind of read several other books before we are able to come back and enjoy that book.
So much of what you're saying, I appreciate the more optimistic take about people wanting to become better readers. And I think, you know, your work makes explicit majoritarianism and often whiteness. And I think that my own grumpiness on this count is about my experience of being read by people who expected that I was writing for them when I actually wasn't. And, you know, thanks to Adichie, we talk about the power of the single story. And I think you're also talking about the power of multiple readings, you know, both by different people at different times in different ways. And thinking about being able to appreciate something, even if it isn't for you, which is an experience and knowledge and habit that is ingrained in so many people who are minoritized in some way, and isn't the habit necessarily of majorities. So I'm so eager to talk about your novel, also in connection to some of the things you've been talking about, and also because I think I felt like I was learning a different way to read because of how tightly the story was built. I wonder if you could read from that novel to take us into our discussion of it. The section starts on page 15, and it's the section where he gets followed to the cave.
Okay.
And it starts at, yeah, I parked on Mount Auburn Street and walked to clear my head.
Okay. You didn't want to get in white men obsessed with their penises.
Oh,
I've already had a lot of that on the show.
Sure, okay. It's called The Cave, and at this point in time in the novel, Matt Kim, who's the narrator, believes that he's disappearing, because people are kind of running to him on the street, don't really acknowledge his presence. One of the examples I like is when he goes to the bathroom in like a long row of urinals, some white dude will just come up and pee right next to him, even though all the other stands are empty. And at this point, there's been an earthquake, which is a thing that happened to me in Boston, which I thought was very strange. Like, I'm in Boston, why is there this earthquake happening? And a box of toys that he had been buying over the last 3 years for his estranged daughter has disappeared. And so he's going to kind of tell his girlfriend that he's right and he really is disappearing. Things are disappearing. I parked on Mount Auburn Street and walked to clear my head. The short stretch of trees before the university could almost fool you into thinking you were in a small town. In the peace between traffic, I could hear bird calls. Then I got to the quaint shops made loud by students. Soon, I regretted coming. Halfway to Harvard Square, the footsteps behind me grew threatening. They kept a beat. My senses expanded in an invisible circle around me. I walked a little farther, and the footsteps kept coming. Finally, I spun on my heels. 20 feet back, at the edge of my sense circle, two white dude bros pretended to chat. They wore hats that said something about this country we all lived in, that it wasn't great anymore. Sweat dripped from my palms. I had suffered some damage to my nervous system. I wondered how long the dude bros had been following me. The other day, the news had reported a white man raping and strangling Asian women in New York's Chinatown. Black males kept getting shot by the police. This was the menace we lived with. I wasn't lucky enough to disappear from menace. It was a menace you could sometimes barely see. I stopped to check whether the dude bros would pass, but they stopped too, and honked their hands at a student in a headscarf. In other words, they made convincing dude bros, and this didn't comfort me. I turned right on JFK Street. The dude bros turned right on JFK Street. They talked about bikes with zero gears, difficulty as a trend. The world wasn't hard enough for them. I tried to walk like JFK, the president, chin level, good Catholic posture, as if going to greet God. I clasped my hands devoutly in front of me and turned into an alley. In my head, I recited, "Ask not what your country can do, etc." I dropped a 10 in the bucket of a brown woman with no legs. When no one followed, I portioned my breath into consistent measures. I listened over my noisy heart. Then I took a series of rides back toward the cave, telling myself there was no reason dude bros would follow me, and two red hats came around the bend. Unless they too had parked on Mount Auburn Street with the plan to walk from there to the cave to get a little air because earlier the toys they had bought had disappeared, they were following me. What was the connection between disappearing and following? I swung my head left as if something fascinating had appeared, and one of them nudged the other. We stood in front of the cave. In the window, my reflection had come an unknowable distance of time and space to meet me. I felt extremely tired, like my reflection's effort had been mine. Before I could censor myself, I asked why the dude bros had followed me. One of them twisted his hat back and forth like, "Who was I talking to?" The other said, "What, you mean us?" "Do you see me?" I asked. "You think you're invisible or something?" I wondered whether that was it. I had mistaken disappearance for invisibility. "Then why are you following me?" The first dude bro touched the second's arm and nodded to go inside, but the second held back. "Wait," he said. "This dude is pissing me off." I pressed my fingers to either temple. "Okay," I said. "Never mind. Maybe it was just in my head. I get carried away sometimes. I've been told I'm not a good judge of people." "No," the second dude bro said. "Tell us more, Charlie Chan. Tell us about your purple tracksuit." He was a hulking specimen, exactly the kind of person who would follow someone, the kind of person who prepared his body to harm another. I looked down at my skinny limbs and frowned. Charlie Chan was a white person, I tried. You make me want to punch you, he said. Make America punch again, I thought. The first dude bro pulled the other's arm and said, come on, he's mental. I stared at my hands. They rubbed each other like two newborn animals. My reflection twitched. One side of my lips lifted higher than the other. The angry dude bro said, dude, this is not over. I never expected anything to be over, though. My hands knew this. I only wanted the world to play by its stated rules. If you minded your own business, why should anyone bother you? Where was the freedom I was promised? When I stopped seeing my family, when I left my job, people called me a quitter, a coward, too proud or ungrateful. But the world could destroy itself on its own. Why did it need me? Suddenly, the angry dude bro turned and spat at my feet. His friend pulled him into the cave. Three drops of saliva fizzled on the purple velour of my pantsuit, of my pant leg. I had worn the tracksuit to feel better about myself. I waited for the spit to dry and thought about my cool, air-conditioned home. Why do we leave our homes? To be with other people, for better or for worse, for richer or for poorer, in sickness and in health. As they passed me, people kept to the edge of the sidewalk or stepped down into the street. I was marked contagious. I rubbed the fur of my tracksuit on a lamp pole and followed the dude bros inside, pretending to be fine. Fake it until you make it to heaven. In the desert, someone else's saliva is a shower. My girlfriend was not at work. The perv who owned the cave said, Sandra isn't answering her phone. She didn't ask for a night off. I told him that wasn't her name anymore. Her name was Yumi, and maybe that was why she wasn't answering. The fuck are you talking about? He asked. He pointed at my chest. Don't you know where she is? What are you even good for?
Thank you so much. I think I read.
I wrote that before the pandemic and the, and the like anti-Asian hate and all that stuff. And it just seems so sadly to be talking about now.
Yeah, I was wondering about that, actually. And that's part of the reason that I, of course, picked that section. You know, I was marked as contagious. And I was reading with Vincent Chin on the brain, in part because of our previous episode and all, everything that's going on right now. And we talked about Vincent Chin and mistaken identity with Peter Ho Davies in our last episode. And in that incident, of course, white assailants mistook Chin, who was adopted from Hong Kong, actually, to be Japanese and killed him. And the rhetoric is sort of, you know, you folks are taking our jobs, and they were auto workers. And in your book, Vincent Chin's murder echoes with other histories of Asian Americans disappearing. And the book begins, actually, with an abbreviated list of disappearances. You also teach Asian American literature. I wonder if you can talk about the different ways that this book engages Asian American histories.
Yeah, so I wanted to write about the kind of mono-minority myth and where it fit within these kind of historical disappearances and the kind of history of immigration law meant to exclude and, you know, frankly, disappear Asian Americans. And I guess I see that myth as an extension of these laws, you know, especially kind of thinking about like the reaction or the perceived reaction to the concentration camps during World War II and people coming out of it kind of with a sort of silence and the feeling that they needed to prove themselves, whether like through fighting in the 112th or, you know, resettling their lives versus the ways in which a lot of property was stolen. Mostly the exodus was a land grab. I mean, it was basically property and land grab of Japanese Americans on the West Coast. At the time when this book was being published, there were a bunch of Japanese Americans, descendants from those interned, and also some people who were still alive from then, protesting the internment of immigrants from Latin America and Mexico in the same concentration camps that were used to hold Japanese Americans during World War II. And it was just this kind of like history repeating itself and disappearing itself in order to kind of be repeated, and the insistence that these things actually happened and that they can't be disappeared. in the, you know, Vincent Chin, one of the things that doesn't seem to be talked about a lot is that he was adopted. And so that's something that kind of speaks to my experience. The idea that, you know, being adopted into America is pretty different in a way from immigrating under different circumstances. And just because kind of as another disappearance within a disappearance. And then I think often of kind of Korean adoptees and the ways in which a lot of the activism Korean adoptees engage in is a kind of like attempt to disappear Korean adoption, international Korean adoption. And so it's like we're like a people trying to disappear ourselves or to like stop any more of us from being made. And so that's a different kind of disappearance. And as I teach Asian American literature, one of the things we often talk about is silence and the ways in which silence can be used against us and the ways that we've taken on silence and kind of done the work of white supremacy for us, for ourselves. But also that there's a way in which this is the main kind of way we talk about silence and the main way we talk about many things having to do with the model minority stereotype and other forms of adaptation and survival within the Asian American community, that in some ways like erases the idea that silence too can be a choice and can be a sort of resistance as well. And that disappearance isn't only something that is used against us, but it's something that maybe we can kind of reclaim and use for good. I mean, for our own kind of reclamation and re-identification.
Matt, thanks so much for joining us. We're really happy to have you here.
Thanks for having me.
Listeners, don't miss Disappear, Doppelganger, Disappear, and of course, Craft in the Real World.
That's it for the Fiction Nonfiction Podcast. This podcast is produced by Andrea Tudhope. Our theme music is composed by Travis Workman. We are launching a new website. It is awesome. It has our back episodes and videos of our back episodes and all kinds of other cool stuff. And you should go check it out at fnfpodcast.net. Thanks to Shashank Murali of the University of Minnesota for building the site, and thanks to Dylan Mietinen, also a Golden Gopher, for helping with its conception. You can subscribe to us by typing fiction/non/fiction into the search bar of your favorite podcast app, and please go give us a rating and review on Apple Podcasts. You can listen, find previous episodes, and read excerpts from our interviews at the Literary Hub website, lithub.com, where the Fiction Nonfiction Podcast page is listed under the LitHub Radio tab. We'll post a link to the books we referenced this week on Facebook at FNF Pod, on Twitter at FNF Talk, and on Instagram at fiction.non.fiction.podcast. You can also find video of this interview at our own Fiction Nonfiction Podcast YouTube channel and on IGTV. You cannot escape us. Happy workshop reading.